justice, blackness, disabled speech, and divinity in this arresting reflection on the human experience. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Good afternoon. And welcome to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host and friend Maria Hall. And we have another one of those special Lawyers Guild shows for you this week. Maria, explain what that's all about.
Hello, Jim. Great to see you on Zoom and hear your voice over the airwaves. We're so excited today to have a special edition of the Lawyers Guild Show, a one-hour conversation with Sharon and Dick Price, longtime activists and friends and the co-founders and publishers of LA Progressive.
Well, as you'll see from my introduction, one reason why we're certainly doing this, I'll start right in if I can. And by the way, in terms of my voice, people who are regular listeners of the show may say, well, you sound sick. I'm really not. What happened was I gave a talk at an outdoor political gathering yesterday, and the loudspeaker system went dead before I spoke. So what we have today is the result of my having to shout my speech. 44 states, friends, have introduced bills or taken other steps that would restrict teaching critical race theory or limit how teachers can discuss racism and sexism. Critical race theory is an academic and legal framework that recognizes systemic racism in the United States. It challenges the idea that racism is abnormal or that it's just a result of individual bias.
Oh, you're first.
In late January, the Department of Defense issued a memo removing the recognition of certain history months, such as Black History Month, Women's History Month, Pride Month, and what have you. And they had a very interesting argument as to why. They claimed that it played a divisive role in American society, My goodness. But we in the National Lawyers Guild, we still strongly believe that such months can play a vital role and a healing role in educating our diverse population on matters often given little or no attention in our lives or, frankly, in our public schools anymore around the nation. So as far as we're concerned, this month, the month of February, is still Black History Month. And we've invited two guests who believe, as we do, to join us here at the Lawyers Guild Show today to discuss, well, racism in America, both historic and present day. That in turn means we're going to be examining critical race theory and consider why white America has so much fear of it being taught in the public schools. Our guests are Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, respectively publisher and editor of the LA Progressive, a daily online magazine widely read throughout the greater Los Angeles area and far beyond. And it's a newspaper online you should be reading every day too. And later in the show, you'll find out how you can do that. Well, Sharon Kyle is Black, Dick Price, who happens to be her husband, is white. Sharon Kyle, Dick Price, a warm welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, nice to see you, Jim and Maria. We're so glad to join you here.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Well, the first question, I guess, is this, and we'll be doing this sometimes, and you'll see the question, Sharon and Sharon, you know, or Sharon or Dick and Sharon, you guys can take turns. When one starts off, the other can finish, or if you feel like it, sometimes say, well, I think somebody else has got a better answer than I do on that. But at any rate, Sharon and Dick, the supposed reason for ending the designation of certain months, as I said, like Black History Month, is that they're supposedly divisive. pitching one race or one gender against another race or gender. So first, Dick, start with you. Do you agree with that rationale? And second, Sharon, what do you believe is the true motivation, that isn't the true motivation, behind the cancellation of months of, like, the Black History Month? Dick?
So in my mind, the people who complain that Black History Month or Women's History Month or similar observances are divisive have it exactly wrong, and they know it. Since the beginning of our country, African Americans have been relegated to a secondary role, denied the best jobs, the best housing, the best neighborhoods, the best schools. Even now, they're often pushed to the margins of society, maybe more subtly in the past, but the result is the same. The point of Black History Month is to signal to Black people that they deserve a seat as much as anyone else, that their history matters as much as any story about George Washington paddling across the Delaware. And Black History Month signals to white people that they need to make sure their Black brothers and sisters are welcome parts of the family, that they need to understand the Black history that is so often different from their own.
Mm-hmm. And Sharon, if you agree with that, then why do you think is the real reason why the powers that be have gotten rid of it?
Right. So I do believe that the powers that be have gotten rid of it. And I think that the reason that they're trying to erase any discussion of race, they call themselves wanting to be colorblind, is because they want to promote this mythical idea of American exceptionalism. So American exceptionalism, this exception that, you know, city on the hill, they want to erase this myth, and they want people to not dig deeper into the makings of America. See, what these kinds of acknowledgments do when it comes to a month or anything mentioning race, it brings to the fore that this country has some major problems. A major contributing problem is that large swaths of white American population do not have an understanding of racism, yet they have benefited tremendously from racism. And so we don't want, the powers that be, the ruling class, don't want these discussions. They want to ban books. They want to ban these months that acknowledge what racism has done to both build this country and make it the richest and most powerful country in the world, or at least it was at one point, and what it has done at the same time to keep boots on the backs of the laborists, the laborers and the people of color, both brown and Black. The work, the labor came from a certain class of people, the benefits were inured by a different class of people, and that's what they want to keep under wraps.
Well, let's talk about one of the new boogeymen of the right, critical race theory. It's become, you know, something, a dog whistle, perhaps. Can we talk about what it is and what it's not? And I understand there are five basic components of critical race theory, the first being the notion that Jim mentioned earlier, that racism is somehow, quote unquote, ordinary, or that it's embedded in society and just the result of individual bias. Sharon Kyle, why don't we start with you and then we'll go to Dick.
Right, okay. So critical race theory is a theory that originated with a renowned legal scholar whose name was Derrick Bell. He's passed away, but he was a Black attorney who really studied the way that racism really is embedded into our justice system, our policies. And so it was originally taught, and I think to a greater extent, it still is originally taught in law schools. You know, so the complaints about critical race theory and the misinformation that's spread about critical race theory is really just it's not accurate. It is a theory that is taught in school. But let's talk about racism being the norm in America. We know that it's ordinary. We know, progressives know. Most people will admit that we still have racism in America. But it's really important to emphasize here that we don't always have the same definition of what racism means. So there are a lot of people, large swaths of the population, that believe that racism is just simply the bad behavior, the hateful behavior of individuals. But it is really a complex system. So it is, but it's much more than that. It operates in the background, negatively impacting the lives of mostly Black and brown people, but other people as well. It's a system of social and political levers and pulleys set up before the founding of this nation. And the consequences were to help powerful people to remain in power. Powerful people established laws, they set policy. And so because they were powerful people and they were the white people, those laws, those policies were infused with the way that they felt about others. And it has become an insidious cultural disease, not just here in America, but globally. It's so insidious that it doesn't care if you're a white person who cares about Black people, like my husband is a white person that cares about Black people, but he still has been imprinted by being raised in this country. So while it's true that many think it is an expression of hatred toward another race, it has many manifestations that come out in the form of privilege and that come out in the form of access to resources. Ignorance is another. You know, some people have the luxury of remaining ignorant of even understanding racism because it doesn't really have a negative impact in their mind. As we talk further, I'm going to make the argument that it has a negative impact on everyone. Ah. Apathy is another problem. So for me, one of the core components of racism is that it's all of those things, but at the bottom line, it's a proxy for determining merit.
Dick, did you want to add to that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Sure. Okay, yeah, I will, Jim, sure. For me, the important distinction is between embedded racism and individual prejudice, as was in the question. It doesn't so much matter whether I like or dislike a particular Black person. CRT helps me understand that even today, that Black person faces subtle forms of discrimination that make his or her life harder, and then I may not even see. For example, we have a friend, an elegant, distinguished Black female law professor, who has given up doing her own clothes shopping, which she loves to do, because she's always followed by security officers, even in the high-toned stores where she likes to shop.
So she hires someone to shop for her.
Right. And as a white person, that's not something I would have observed and would only know because she told us the story with a certain amount of sadness.
That's amazing. I'm not shocked, but I'm disgusted. But all right. Dear me. Well, Dick, the second component then is this component that they refer to in critical race theory, intersectionality, fancy word, intersectionality. That is that race is not the only identity that impacts a person's life, and so that it's important, therefore, to consider how race interacts with other identities. Dick, first you talk to us about this, and then we'll get Sharon's view of it.
I'm going to talk about it because even though Dick has experienced intersectionality. Oh. So intersectionality is simply the overlapping of identities. So I am both Black and female and old now. So I have a lot of identities that intersect. And in my case, most of the identities that I have are ones that are undervalued in this country. The dominant culture is Christian, and I'm Christian. And there's a few that I have that are beneficial, but for the most part, my identities give me a disadvantage. Dick's identities, he has nationality as well, but his identities give him an advantage. So Kimberly Crenshaw tells a story about a company who, from a statistical perspective, this company had a diverse workforce. They were doing great. On paper, it looked like women were doing well, Blacks were doing well. They report this and with pride. But when you dug a little deeper, you found that Black women didn't have a shot at being promoted and they were discriminated against. But when you just looked at, well, how are Blacks doing? When you dug deeply, you saw, oh, they've counted Black men. Well, women doing? Oh, women? Yeah. White women. Well, the Black women were down at the bottom, usually, cleaning the toilets. So this observation of Kimberly Crenshaw's led to the exploration of intersectionality, a term that she coined and that looks at the overlapping identities and the compounding impact of belonging to more than one identity. So let's take income inequality. There are so many compounding impacts to being female and being Black. There are terms like the feminization of poverty that are much more impactful to Black women when it comes to child rearing and divorce and illness. It can just go on and on. But at the bottom line, it results in a material impact that is negative to our pockets. And believe me, I know. I raised two children, and I knew that I had to work harder, do better, just to be at par with my contemporaries that were white.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall, here with my co-host, Jim Lafferty. I did want to remind listeners that it is KPFK's Fund Drive time, and our wonderful host station, KPFK, needs all of us to pitch in and keep the airwaves loud and free. Because, as you can see, we have this great programming, including being here with us the whole hour today, a conversation with Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, long-term activists and publisher of LA Progressive. And, you know, just by listening to KPFK, you're already taking the first step of being the resistance and appealing to our common decency and truth. And by pledging a little gift, you are even upping the ante a little bit. But please give what you can, and I'm going to ask the next question. Okay, so the third component of critical race, as I understand it, is called interest convergence. Interest convergence. And basically, that's racial progress can only happen when the interests of marginalized groups align with those of the powerful. Can you tell us more about this component, whoever wants to start?
Yeah, I'll start. So this is actually kind of problematic. But the U.S. is dominated by a rich and powerful elite, as we know, based on a study by Princeton University professor Martin Gillens and Northwestern University professor Benjamin I. Page, who studied policy in the U.S. and who sets it for over 10 years. They found that the only time regular people got policy that was in their interest was when that policy was also desired by the money elite. The problem is that in our current environment where we're experiencing, when woke and CRT and DRT are ridiculed and dismissed at the various highest levels of our government, times that the needs of Black people align with the dominant white nationalist society may be very few and far between. So Black people may need to focus on progress on its own terms for themselves in the interim, separate from racial progress related to white people, until a more progressive mode sweeps across the country as it did during the vaunted civil rights era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is fascinating, isn't it? As is the next one. We're covering five of the main components, but there are other components as well, but could only get to so much. Sharon, I'm wondering, the fourth component of critical race theory is that race is a social construct, not a biological reality. And what is meant by that? Clearly, some people are darker skinned than others. Is there no such thing as race? Or do people misunderstand what this component is really about?
So scientists, like in the last, I'm going to say 30 years, they have found that from a biological perspective, we are one race. The human being has one racial category, and that is the race of humanity. However, there has been a constructed idea that divides humans, and that idea is called race. So this construction of race is broadly accepted to have its beginnings in the late 1600s. So in the late 1600s, here in the United States, but in the colonies, specifically in Virginia, there was a rebellion Most people believe that it was the biggest rebellion in colonial America, and it was called Bacon's Rebellion. And it was an armed uprising. It happened in 1676 by the Virginia colonists led by Nathaniel Bacon. So what was happening back then is that Blacks, whites, indentured servants, slaves, all of the laborers that were clearing the land, and you know, this is in the early beginnings of America, they were working together, living together, eating together, playing together, intermarrying. You know, they had a common goal, and it was to survive in these colonies. They had some problems with Native Americans, rightfully so, being pissed off and attacking them. And so Nathaniel Bacon decided, and others, to join forces. All of the laborers joined forces and throw out William Berkeley, who was the governor of Virginia, because he had reneged on his promise to protect the laborers. Well, they were so successful at that rebellion, it took a year for the British to be able to gain control of the colony again. But during that year, they came up with a strategy to divide and conquer. And that is what we, many people, call the construction of race. They came up with a way to break down these people that thought they were one people and to divide them by the white people did not think of themselves as white people. They were the English, they were the Irish, they were, you know, whatever nationality they were, but they did not see themselves as a race. And to a great extent, even today, white people do not racialize themselves. They racialize others. They don't really have a sense of the white race and what that means. And so that's what this construction of race means, is that it was socially constructed, economically constructed for the benefit of the white, wealthy, ruling British class.
I just wanted to stop just for a moment because it strikes me that that is so profoundly goes to the core of things. And Dick, if you want to join in, please do. Just to complete this one thought, though, I mean, every species, I mean, not every species, but when we think of cows, when we think of horses, when we think of, I don't know, fish in the ocean, they're all fish of a species, but they look many different colors. They have many different shapes, but and we identify them as goldfish, maybe, or perch or bass for purposes of identifying them. But we understand they're all one species. They're all fish, or they're all cows. They're all whatever. We're just all human beings. And for a variety of reasons, we have different colors, different interests, sometimes different cultures that we come from that may make us look at life differently. But the notion that we're all separate races is, when you think about it, pretty stupid and came about for pretty obviously not very healthy reasons. I'm sorry, Dick, were you trying to join in and I jumped right ahead of you?
Oh, yeah. No, I was just going to rephrase, give my own thoughts on what Sharon had to say.
Please,
and
please.
Kind of what you just said. So, I mean, for the white governing elite, the advantage of race and racism is to keep people focused on advancing their own race or ethnicity and fighting against other races rather than uniting around their common economic disadvantages instead of directing their anger at the people at the top who've imposed unequal economic conditions on them, whatever their skin color. So it's to the elite's advantage to foment dissension among the races, as they did in the Bacon's Rebellion, to make sure Black and white people think it's people of the other race who are making their lives miserable and difficult, not the fact that they live in an unfair economic system.
Mm. And by the way, just, I should have pointed this out earlier, and maybe it doesn't sound this way over the radio, but to my ear, sometimes, especially with Sharon, you break up a little bit. Maybe he's got a better shot at the mic than you do. Maybe that white guy next to you has got the better
position. That's one of my privileges.
So let her scoot over there, too, and have a better shot at that mic, and then I think she'll break up less often. It's just a small pun. No, we haven't heard everything, but just to make it even go more smoothly. I'm sorry, Maria, you had a question, I know.
Yeah, no worries. I wanted to get to another really critical component of critical race theory, which is my favorite, And that is the component of storytelling. Storytelling and counter-storytelling are just such important tools for us to be able to understand the personal experiences of other people. Can you explain that a little bit? Maybe give us some examples of why it says about the importance of storytelling is true.
Yeah. So I have a couple stories that opened my eyes in some respects. So years ago in my 30s, I ran a half that was about, had 20 guys, and it was about equally divided among Black guys, white guys, and Latinos. Daily at lunchtime, they had to walk down four blocks down the main drag in town to a meeting hall. And almost every day, the police officers, who were not all white, there were some Black and some Latino and mostly white, but they would cruise by the group of white guys, give them the high sign, and keep on moving. Then with the Latinos, they would slow down and ask the Latinos to come over to the car and explain what they were doing in that part of town. And then with the Black guys, more often than not, they would have them seated on the curb, making a big show of checking their IDs, just like they checked their IDs the day before, which was meant to diminish them, to make them feel unwelcome, and just exert their power. And I witnessed that. I mean, because the guys would come back to my place who didn't necessarily live in that part of town, and they would say, "What's up with this?" And I did eventually arrange a session with the police department, and they came and they understood it, but they didn't really understood it. Another story I had when I was a young teenager, I lived in the white suburbs of farthest out suburbs of Minneapolis. But across the street was my best friend, who was a Black guy, a little bit older than me. And we would get on our bikes in the summer and ride miles and miles and miles into North Minneapolis, more of the Black neighborhood, and go to a swimming pool there. And it slowly dawned on me, without him really saying what was going on, it was because he would feel so unwelcome if we went to a local white swimming pool. And that was another opener to me. And life is kind of, if you pay attention to them, there's a series of them. For a white person, can kind of get an insight into what it's like to be Black. And on the other hand, if you choose not to, you can just blow past it and forget it.
All right. Well, let's move on beyond this. We've been discussing so far the role of critical race theory in explaining the way that the dominant white culture in America has discriminated against Black skin people. But is it not also true that in America there is discrimination between the various types of people of color, Hispanic people against Black people and the reverse, Asian people against Black people and the reverse? Does critical race theory do a good job of explaining this phenomena, or is that simply where a different explanation is needed?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me fine? It's better when you when you go forward like that, Sharon. You're loud and clear, and that's what you'll have to do too, Dick.
Yeah. Okay, so it's an interesting question. So I've been to several critical race theory symposiums that are conducted here in Los Angeles at UCLA's law school. And I've gone to a few talks given by Kimberly Crenshaw, Cheryl Harris, and others. And I've done a lot of readings with content that was written by Derek Bell, the legal scholar that we kind of talked about a little bit earlier, who was the one who originated the whole concept of critical race theory. And his position was that CRT was based on critical legal studies. It's a branch of legal scholarship. So I have to admit that there was little or no discussion of colorism or racism within people of color groups. But I will say that global acceptance of positive associations with whiteness and negative associations with Blackness and other people of color due to the spread of white supremacy ideology, that's transmitted globally and throughout this country and within all of the races. It's even been internalized by Black people, brown people, Asian Americans, It includes things like respectability politics. And for those of your listeners who are unfamiliar with respectability politics, it's a term we use within the Black community. Many of you may remember before Bill Cosby was disgraced, he used to be like everybody's father. And he would talk about how Black young men just need to pull up their pants, almost as if the way that you dress, if you don't wear a hoodie, this is respectability politics. If you speak a certain way and you project a certain image, and all the time, it is the way and the image that white supremacy says that you should project, then everything will be okay. And so that's where that comes from. It comes from a belief that there is these positive associations with whiteness and negative associations with Blackness. And that belief is widely held globally as well as within the races. So yes, there is colorism. And yes, there are there is discrimination even within the race itself.
Mm-hmm. I see that we're right at the point where we should take a station ID break so that we don't interrupt the next answer or the next question. So we'll take that brief break and then we'll be right back. Listeners, don't go anywhere.
Hey, this is Wanda Sykes, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. And if you'd like to shell out a few bucks, you know, keep us up and running so I can have nice conversation in a cool voice like this. Pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you.
And we are back with you. Very short break. We appreciate that. Before we get started, and this is Jim Lafferty, still along with Maria Hall, of course, the co-host of the show, and still as well with Dick Price and Sharon Kyle. We'll get back to our guests in a second, but we do need to take a couple minutes here and there to remind you that we are in a winter fund drive. And why that's important. I was thinking earlier as Sharon and Dick were talking about one of the elements of critical race theory, which is intersectionality. I was thinking about the fact that when you make a pledge to KPFK, right now, in fact, we're giving a portion of the money to Habitat for Humanity, which considering we don't have much money, I think is a good but generous thing to do. There's a certain intersectionality there. An even bigger one, I think, is the fact that there aren't other radio stations in L.A. that regularly have on people from the movement, people who are running the immigrant rights movement or the Black activist movement. But we do that regularly here, week after week. If you listen to KPFK, not just on the Lawyers Guild show, but other shows, you will hear what the progressive movement in L.A. is doing, not just in a soundbite, but with some depth. And therefore, when you contribute to KPFK, you're contributing to the betterment and the advancement of the progressive cause, because it's important for that cause to be able to get its message out. God knows corporate America does. God knows those who have a non-progressive view manage to get their, they have the money and the wherewithal to get their message out. But there aren't a lot of places in the country for the progressive movements that I know many of you who are listening right now support. So you can feel good when you contribute to the station, because not only do you keep the station on the air, but you help build the progressive movements. You're giving a sense to all the movements in town when you give to KPFK. And on this particular occasion, in fact, and we do this periodically with other groups, we're giving a portion of the money that you do contribute to Habitat for Humanity in light of all the great work they're doing with respect to the terrible fire damage, the terrible homelessness problem, and destructive problem that took place and that we're still feeling the effects of here in L.A. Now, you can call us at 818-985-5735, or you can go to the website, which Maria likes to talk about. I think I've become a fan of it myself, because there you'll see very many ways in which we say thank you when you contribute various amounts. Maybe it's $50, maybe it's $100, maybe it's $500 or $1,000. Those of you that have a good job are hoping you'll do that, because a lot of people listening aren't in such great shape. And that's okay. We keep listening, my friends. Don't feel guilty about the fact that you can't make a contribution. But those of you that can and could contribute for your neighbor who maybe is out of work, think about doing that as well, my friends. And if you go to the website, you'll find out lots of ways at various levels of giving that there are ways in which we say thank you. Have you looked at this time at Maria to know which sweatshirt or which cup? Maria, I think, has collected every cup from the fund drives going back to goodness knows when.
There's so much great stuff and just to look at it. And of course, the Habitat for Humanity, option if you wanted some portion to go to a good cause. But yeah, so many cultural, tickets, CDs, Black History Month compilations, just amazing stuff on the website for you to look at and as a thank you gift for making your pledge.
No, and I often take advantage of the musical ones because you can't always find these great collections of performers who may be dead now, but whose music still lives on. But if you want to get a particularly unique collection at a reasonable price and still be contributing to KPFK, that's the way to go. Documentary films, books, you name it, we've got ways to say thank you. You can turn around and give those as gifts yourself. So there's lots of reasons to give us a call at 818-985-5735, or as Maria says, and I agree, go to the website, kpfk.org. It's simple and figure out what your amount of giving is, but please give something, my friends. All right, now back to our questioning with our wonderful guests. I'm trying to remember where
yes,
we...
It is my turn, Jim.
Your turn. See, why do you guys try to just butt in? Go ahead.
I know. No, you're great. So yeah, and just for listeners, we are here with Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, spending the hour in conversation. And they, of course, if you don't know them, they are activists, longtime activists, friends, and publishers of LA Progressive, which is fantastic, a fantastic resource. And we're talking about Black History Month in general, but more about how Black history isn't going to go away just because this president wants to erase it from the calendar, because that really was too much too little too late anyway, but it is all of our history. So, okay. So next question, much has been written about how during the time of slavery in the South, and of course after, there was a concerted effort to convince the poor people who might be considered, quote unquote white, that they actually had more in common with rich white people than with any Black person. And it's written that, it was done on purpose. Isn't this still true today all over the United States? This intentional keeping of working class and lower income people in poverty from uniting in their common fight for better wages, a union, civil rights, human rights, and the end to discrimination. What can you tell us about that? How about Sharon?
So you're so right, Maria. Really, there has been an effort to keep the working class fractured for at least 400 years. Deep-pocketed individuals and now today wealthy global corporations benefit the most. And I wanted to bring up two tragedies that highlight how the United States today, contemporary United States, is still in this trap. I'm going to bring up the name, Fred Hampton. Mm. Many people may remember that Fred Hampton was a very young Black Panther. He was an anti-racist and anti-classist. He was a Rainbow Coalition prominent multicultural political organizer. He believed that Black Panthers and the Young Patriots, who at that time, this is back in the 60s, they were organizing for whites, and the Young Lords, who were organizing Hispanics, and Chicago street gangs, that they should all come together, because Hampton felt that fascism was the greatest threat to the United States. And during that period, he was so articulate and charismatic. He was really bringing all of these disparate parts together. Well, J. Edgar Hoover didn't like that. So J. Edgar Hoover, the United States head of the FBI, he developed this program called COINTELPRO. And COINTELPRO, against constitutional rule and against constitutional law, placed under surveillance average people. Martin Luther King was one of those people. But he had plants, people watching every move that Fred Hampton made. And he considered Fred Hampton, he treated him as he was a criminal. And based on extensive research, many people believe that the FBI had a hand in Fred Hampton's assassination. He was assassinated at the age of 21 when it became clear that he was becoming more and more successful at bringing poor whites, blacks, Latinos together. And the same thing happened with Martin Luther King Jr. He made this famous speech Beyond Vietnam on April 4th, 1967, exactly a year before he was assassinated. And he made it clear that the problem that we have in the country is that we need better working conditions and higher wages, and we need to form unions. So bringing together of the races is something that the wealthy have been very successful at keeping us fractured and divided.
Mm-hmm. Dick, did you want to add to that? Or I'm sorry, I say, Dick, would you care to add anything to that?
The separation of us.
Should I do something?
Come close to the mic, Dick. Come close.
I can report on my own experiences with DEI training. I only participated in, it's kind of relevant to what Sharon said. Mm-hmm. I participated to one official and with a well-known activist group and some volunteers and staff from there. But the idea was with CRT, it wasn't only played around the black-white dynamic. It also involved, other groups, Latinos, women, Asian American, trans people, pretty much in the news today, have the same kind of discrimination. Now, the pain falls especially hard on black people. It's harder. It's more deeply ingrained and lasts longer. But I surprised. I mean, among the people there were, as I say, liberal and thought they were all on top of it. Me too, thought we're on top of issues of racism and the plight of black people. But by getting in a room and going through some of the program, I think I and others were surprised that we learned from other people, especially black people, who shared with us, like my story about our friend, the black professor. You wouldn't know that unless you can break down some walls and hear what it's like to be a black person in a white dominated world.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, certainly people of color, black people and other people of color, have made some progress. Some would argue considerable progress since the times of slavery, and there's been progress in employment and in housing opportunities and the like, despite the discrimination that still abides there. But that's not to suggest that by any stretch of the imagination, blacks and other people of color live and work in America as in any way respect with equal rights to white folks. Because sometimes people get confused by that. You say, well, they got all these good civil rights laws, You can't discriminate in hiring. Oh, I know there's still some of that. But by and large, if you're qualified, you're black, you're going to get the job if you're better qualified than the white man or woman who applied for it. Is that true? I mean, even despite this, there has been some progress. But have we not reached a point where it's rather stymied because it's sort of gone as far as it can go, given the current set in the country? Sharon, you want to... Dick, who wants to?
Yeah,
you, please.
So Jim, Dick and I have been married for over 20 years. And in the first 10 years of our marriage, we had a recurring argument. And the argument started when he would ask, don't you think that there's been some progress for black people? You know, we would get in such. And I started doing some research to try to understand why white people and black people have such a different about where this country stands when it comes to matters of race. And an Irish article that made a major distinction, and they said that when you ask white liberals to gauge how this country is doing on racism, and the ways that and the ways that black people are treated better now than before, what they do is they look to the past. So the difference, according to the right, is that white people look at how we've come. But when you look at black people and you ask They're looking at how far we need to go. And I would get into an argument with Dick and say, I don't care about how far we've come. When I brought my child into this, into the world, my son, who is a Black man now, came out as a Black baby, I didn't tell him, well, you should feel fortunate. Yes, racism still exists, but it used to be so much worse. No, I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about where we need to be. And the reason I'm concerned about where we need to be is because I don't want to measure the depth of the racism. Let's just get rid of it. It's also really important to understand that the well-being of this country can be measured by how we treat the populace. The well-being of vulnerable, marginalized, oppressed people is a measure of the health of a democracy. A healthy society cannot. It can't. You go downtown to Los Angeles right now, go around like 9th and Los Angeles Street. You wouldn't believe your. This is not a condition for a democracy, and it's beginning to appear that we're on the edge of collapse. And how did that get that way? Because of the profound segregation. We used to have state sanctioned and state mandated segregation. Now we have. We accept this. And it is beginning to impact all of us.
So if I could break in, Jim. So one thing I learned for 20 years of being married to a Black woman and 30 years being a father of a Black child is there's a concept called feathering. And it's true on the books. It's illegal to discriminate against people in the workplace, in the hiring place. It's illegal to discriminate in the promotions. It's illegal to discriminate in the admissions to colleges. But Black people know that there's subtle ways that those kind of prejudice still raise their ugly head. And the thing I've seen being married to Sharon is that it takes a toll. It takes a daily toll. You know, we come down and we turn on the news and yet another Black boy in Akron, Ohio has been shot dead. And I absorb the news. Yes. Oh, my God, that's terrible. But I see it's a weight on her because she has a Black son. She has a Black brother. She has a bunch of Black male cousins. And it's a worry. And the result is the statistics are that Black people don't live as long as white people. And it's not genetic. It's because the country we have is unfair. It's unfair in ways that it's like the story of the friend of ours who shopped in the store. I wouldn't know that unless she told me. Well, I wouldn't know how hard this is on this particular Black woman and a lot of her Black friends if I didn't see what it does to her in those mornings when I come down. And the news is as dismal as it sometimes is.
Oh, dear. Yes. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Maria.
Oh, yes. Well, Dick and Sharon, it's been about actually over 600 years since Columbus sailed those ocean blues. Ocean blue and leading to some blues. And as you've pointed out, there's still nothing close to equal rights or opportunity between white power structure and Black people and people of African descent in the U.S. Do you believe that equality or anything close to it will ever come about in the United States? And if it is possible, what's it going to take to make that a reality?
So, you know, I think about that a lot. One ray of hope that I have is that even though Dick and I are from two different parts of the world, you know, ethnic difference, the Bronx, the projects of New York. He was born in the white suburbs, like he's suburbs of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Both of his parents had PhDs. My father was a bus driver and my mom really didn't work and they both had high school educations. I've come to see that if you are intentional about wanting to make things work, you can do it. But there's got to be some A, intentionality behind it. B, you have to not rely on information that's bad. You really need to gird yourself in an education that's steeped in history and the true history, this banning of books and, you know, trying to erase all of the ugly things that America did. That doesn't serve this country. But the one thing I think that we tend to not talk enough about, and that is how this is going to impact everyone. And I in the last question, I do believe that when all people come to understand that they personally have a vested interest in eradicating racism from an economic standpoint, as businesses understood that this is poor business practice that results in doing as well as they could. If they would embrace diversity, they would improve their businesses. If we would embrace diversity in the United States, we could improve the health of the democracy. You really can't functioning democracy when there's just a handful of people. That's not a democracy, that's an oligarchy. So I think that the number one thing that is going to make a change is when everyone understands that they all have a vested interest in making this country work for everyone.
Well, we have go ahead, Dick, please.
Hmm? Yeah, so between us, I'm the glass half full guy, maybe because of my advantages. But when I was a kid and participating with the Methodist Youth Fellowship in civil rights thing, going knocking on doors, raising funds for the Freedom Riders at 14, moving to New York City, living on the edge of Harlem, and participating in civil rights demonstrations at 17, I thought that we were going to conquer racism. I mean, laws were being passed. I mean, the discrimination was falling down. And I thought the ugly old white bigots, the Strom Thurmonds and the George Wallaces and the Lester Maddoxes and all their Ku Klux Klan buddies would die off and they'd be replaced by a much more sensible liberal populace. And the truth is, in the current day, we can see I was absolutely wrong. We have a resurgence of white nationalists that has this one advantage, I think. I think it could spur people to lock arms together the way they did during the civil rights movement and demand change. I don't think it's going to just osmosis and happen. I don't think it, you know, writing LA Progressive articles is going to make it happen. I think people are going to have to, in effect, go to the lunch counters and get beat on to make something real happen.
Mm. Well, I can't argue with that personally. Now, we do just have a couple of minutes left, but I really do want you to spend a couple of minutes talking about, you mentioned the LA Progressive. I mentioned it at the top of the show. Dick, Sharon, tell us, our listeners, what the LA Progressive is. If they don't know, my goodness, they should, and how they go about becoming regulars.
So anyone can visit the LA Progressive, just go to laprogressive.com, and you will find our digital political progressive magazine. It is a daily magazine. Dick, you can talk a little bit about the things that you do, but we offer content that helps to inform the public so that they are not gobbled up by misinformation.
Yeah, up along the top of that page of our homepage, laprogressive.com, is a subscribe button, and subscriptions are free. And if you want, you can get a daily newsletter from us that has great articles from some of them written by us, some of them contributed. Really interesting stuff. The hallmark of our publication is the centrality of race. So what we're talking about, we're oftentimes talking about racial issues. And if you feel like KPFK and Jim was saying, if you'd like to sign up and donate, we won't turn the money away.
Okay, so Dick and I are getting ready to have an argument right here online. And the subscriptions are not free. We just don't have a paywall. We don't force people to pay, but we rely on people. Somebody worked to put this thing together. And if you read it, it would be nice if you pay for it. And you should understand it's not free, but we're not going to stop you from reading it because we want people to digest this information.
Well, that's right. And I encourage people to not simply, I encourage you, first of all, read it, because when you do read it, after you've read it a couple of days, you'll understand you're getting a lot more out of it than you're getting out of the LA Times when it comes to things that might mean a lot to you, and you're paying a hell of a lot more for the LA Times. So think about that when you decide to send some money there, because yes, anybody can watch it for free, but by God, if people don't support it, you can't expect these two people. They're not rich folks. You can't expect them to do this constantly and take it out of their own pocket. Well, I'm afraid that we are out of time. I'm not quite sure how many announcements, but we do need to save a minute to again plead for our listeners to support us. So let me just say, Sharon Kyle and Dick Price, how much I appreciate the LA Progressive and all the work that you folks do in this town to make this a better place. And we sure thank you for joining us here on the Lawyers Guild Show today.
This has been delightful, Jim and Maria. Thanks so much for inviting us.
All right.
Ditto.
All right. Well, now, before we are completely out of time, I haven't heard our music yet.
We have about 2.5 minutes to wrap.
There you go. That's plenty of time to raise $1,000, right?
That's right. I already put mine in. Not for that much, but a little bit.
What did you get for your thank you gift?
For my thank you, I got the Richie Valens CD.
There you go.
And a subscription to Downbeat magazine. But it's not like you're buying it. It's just a thank you
for your
pledge to KPFK, because that's where the real prize is in giving to KPFK and keeping the airwaves going.
We like to think so, certainly. We like to think so. You're listening to it. We suspect you think this station has some value, too. Well, fair is fair. You get a meal, you pay for it. You get the LA Times, you pay for it. You get a magazine, you pay for it. You don't have to pay. It's like the LA Progressive, I guess. That way you don't have to pay for KPFK, but we sure wish you would. And not paying for it, but support it to show that you do appreciate the programming, the music, the drama, all of the various kinds of programming we have, certainly a lot of public affairs programmings. We hope you appreciate the Lawyers Guild Show. And that's why we always ask you to call in during our show, so that we kind of get a little pat on the back for helping to raise some of the funds that we need here.
We love our brownie points. One thing I've been hearing so much of recently is, you know, intelligent people who are trying to talk about issues, and they're really struck by how complex our society is right now, and mm-hmm. how the misinformation is just making it so much worse. So please, like the chance to get an in-depth interview like we did today and on so many other programs on KPFK is invaluable. And it really is for us, for the future of our society, making things better. You cannot rely on those, you know, the news, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news, breaking news, etc. Yeah.
No, you're right. Without any in-depth to it at all. And we are able to do that here. We like to think that, therefore, as I said earlier, when you contribute to this station, you keep on the voice of the progressive movement in Los Angeles and beyond. So do that, my friends. Give us a call, 818-985-5735. Make a pledge of as much as you can afford. $25 and you're a full-fledged member of the family here. But we hope that you can contribute even more, of course. We're not shy about that. As I said earlier, those of you that have a good job and are not so hurting for money, by all means, contribute twice as much as you would otherwise do, or three times as much. Let it be known that you're supporting some of your brothers and sisters who aren't as fortunate as you are. But whatever it is, whether you go online at kpfk.org, where you decide what you're going to give, and then you can pick out a way of saying, we say thank you to you for doing it, or whether you call us on the phone at 818-985-5735. Do one or the other, my friends, before the show is over. Or if you don't get to before it's over, that's okay. Do it later today. Do it tomorrow. But do it. Don't let this fun drive go by. You'll feel better. I tell you, you just do. You may say, oh, geez, I got to pay another $50 or another $100 for this. Yeah, well, but you'll feel better. You really will. And if you can afford to do it, by all means, do it, my friends. Until next week at the same time, I guess our music about to play. Part of the problem with doing it the way we do it now, where we're all scattered about, is that we can't get a cue from our master control. As to exactly how much time is left. But I think we're just about out of time. We have about 2 minutes to go on the hour. They'll no doubt have a couple of announcements they'll want to make. So as the music begins to play, my friends, You remember that we're wanting you to stay healthy. We're wanting you to come back with us next week when we'll be back with another program. And to stay healthy and to stay active and stand up for your rights as the
beef. Celebrate Black history. Woo-hoo, because it's everybody's history. It's not going away.
Oh, boy, it's our history.